This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Marjorie Cohn analyzes recent oral arguments before the Supreme Court in the case of Trump v. Anderson.
It appears that all members of the Supreme Court except Sonia Sotomayor are prepared to ignore the Constitution and allow Trump to remain on the ballot.
We also speak with Misha Jerakulis from Project Censored about bias in the corporate media.
Misha details how the corporate media slants its coverage in favor of Israel and against the Palestinians.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
On February 8th, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Trump v. Anderson. At issue is whether the Colorado Supreme Court erred in holding that Donald Trump is disqualified from the office of the presidency. With that finding, he was barred from being listed on Colorado's 2024 presidential primary ballot. The Colorado court had held that Trump's participation in the January 6th insurrection makes him ineligible under the disqualification clause in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. During the arguments, with the exception of Sonia Sotomayor, all of the members of the Supreme Court, many of whom identify as originalists, signaled that they are prepared to ignore the command of the disqualification clause and refuse to allow Colorado to exclude Trump from their ballot. Section 3 was enacted by Congress in the wake of the Civil War to disqualify people from holding office who had served in government prior to the war, but then supported the Confederacy. Nevertheless, during the Trump v. Anderson oral arguments, the Supreme Court members all but ignored the January 6th insurrection, the greatest threat to the survival of the Republic since the Civil War. With us today to deconstruct the oral arguments and predict what the High Court is likely to do is our own co-host Marjorie Cohn. She's professor of law emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. Marjorie is also Dean of the People's Academy of International Law and a member of the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. She writes frequent articles about the Supreme Court for Truthout. Marjorie, welcome back to the interview seat on Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks for interviewing me, Heidi.
Marjorie, what exactly does the disqualification clause say?
Well, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment states, "No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress, or elector of president and vice president, or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States, or under any state, who, having previously taken an oath, as a member of Congress or an officer of the United States or a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state, to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection against the same, but Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each House, remove such disability."
And can you briefly tell our listeners what were the main concerns of the members of the Supreme Court at the oral arguments?
Well, several members of the court seemed inclined to accept Trump's argument that the president is not an officer of the United States. That's a proposition so ludicrous you don't have to be a lawyer to see its absurdity. Some members who purport to be originalists appeared prepared to read into Section 3 a requirement that Congress pass legislation before the disqualification can be invoked. And some members of the court were concerned that if states were allowed to enforce the Section 3 disqualification, that chaos would result.
Please explain the issue about whether Section 3 applies to the presidency.
Well, in questioning whether the president is a, quote, officer, unquote, of the United States, Neil Gorsuch and Ketanji Brown Jackson cited Section 3's listing of several officers that didn't include the president. Of course, that section also includes any office, civil or military, and the Constitution calls the president an officer in several other places. But Gorsuch and Jackson prepared to agree with Trump's claim that officers refers only to appointed officers, not elected ones. But Sonia Sotomayor called that interpretation a bit of a gerrymandered rule. Now, Gorsuch and Alito, Samuel Alito, thought that this lawsuit might be premature because Section 3 forbids insurrectionists only from holding office, not running for office. Another ridiculous distinction, because how can you hold office without running for it? And they noted that if Trump were elected, Congress could move the disqualification by a two-thirds vote before his term began. Now, Jason Murray, an attorney representing the Colorado voters who were challenging Trump's eligibility, noted that Article 2 and the 10th Amendment to the Constitution give the states the authority to run presidential elections. And as such, they have the power to ensure that their citizens' electoral votes are not wasted on a candidate who's constitutionally barred from holding office. Now, just because Congress can remove the disability by a two-thirds vote does not implicitly bestow on Trump a constitutional right to run for offices that he can't hold in violation of state law and state procedure under Article 2, Murray said.
What was the concern about whether states like Colorado can enforce Section 3?
Brett Kavanaugh said that the original public meaning of Section 3 was that Congress must pass a statute before an officer could be disqualified from holding office because Section 3 is not self-executing. It needs a congressional statute. They seem to ignore the fact that the Supreme Court held in the 1883 civil rights cases that the 14th Amendment is undoubtedly self-executing without any ancillary legislation. But Kavanaugh turned instead to Griffin's case, a lower court case, which is not binding precedent on the Supreme Court. And that case said that Section 3 is not self-executing. It requires a congressional enactment. And Congress passed the Enforcement Act of 1870 after Griffin's case to execute or implement Section 3. Of course, that act was repealed in the 1940s. Now, when Jackson pressed Murray about the lack of uniformity if states are allowed to enforce Section 3, Murray said the framers were concerned most about ensuring that insurrectionists and rebels don't hold office. And Murray said it would be a little bit odd to say that states can't enforce it, that only the federal government can enforce it, and that Congress can essentially rip the heart out of Section 3 by a simple majority just by failing to pass enforcement legislation. But instead of focusing on whether Trump did participate in an insurrection against the U.S. on January 6th, Elena Kagan, Amy Coney Barrett, and John Roberts, along with Jackson, Alito, and Kavanaugh, were concerned that a single state could decide the issue. Kagan said, "Why should a single state decide who gets to be president? And why should a single state make this determination not only for their own citizens, but for the rest of the nation? That sounds awfully national to me and quite extraordinary, doesn't it?" Murray responded that Colorado was deciding only for its voters to enforce the disqualification clause, much like it would exclude candidates from the presidency who were under 35 years old, not born in the U.S., or had already served two terms. Those are disqualifications that are also contained in the Constitution. Jackson doubted whether the drafters meant to establish disinformity in this way, where we have elections pending and different states suddenly saying you're eligible, you're not. Barrett worried about a situation in which the factual record wasn't fully developed in state court and how the high court should review these findings. She said it just doesn't seem like a state call. Alito was troubled by different states reaching different conclusions about the admissibility of evidence, what rules of evidence apply, what burden of proof, and that he was worried the Supreme Court would have to decide those issues. And both Alito and Roberts were wary of what Alito called the danger of a cascading effect if they affirmed Colorado Supreme Court's decision disqualifying Trump. Kavanaugh declared that Congress has the authority here, not the states. And this is interesting, Heidi, because Kavanaugh, he upheld voter suppression laws right and left leading up to the 2020 election. Kavanaugh says the court should think about democracy, think about the right of the people to elect candidates of their choice, of letting the people decide, and worried that enforcing Section 3 against Trump has the effect of disenfranchising voters to a significant degree. A bit hypocritical. In response, Murray told Kavanaugh, the reason we're here is that President Trump tried to disenfranchise 80 million Americans who voted against him, and the Constitution doesn't require that he be given another chance. Now, none of these members of the court mentioned that the 14th Amendment was enacted by Congress and signed by the president in a quintessential exercise of democracy. And Murray told the members of the court, the framers of Section 3 knew from painful experience that those who had violently broken their oaths to the Constitution couldn't be trusted to hold power again because they could dismantle our constitutional democracy from within, and so they created a democratic safety valve. President Trump can go ask Congress to give him amnesty by a two-thirds vote, but unless he does, our Constitution protects us from insurrectionists. And then finally, I just wanted to point out, Heidi, that the Colorado trial court held a five-day hearing during which the evidence amassed by the bipartisan select committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol was presented. And Trump had the opportunity at that hearing to call witnesses, to cross-examine the opponent's witnesses, and to testify. And the Colorado Supreme Court affirmed the trial court's finding that Trump had committed insurrection by trying to overturn the election, by altering electoral vote counts, promoting false slates of electors, pressuring then Vice President Mike Pence to violate his constitutional duty, and urging a march on the Capitol.
Marjorie, did the members of the court discuss whether Donald Trump actually engaged in insurrection on and before January 6, 2021?
Well, that's a good question, Heidi. Murray began his argument to the court by saying our nation's capital came under violent assault for the first time since the War of 1812. For the first time in history, the attack was incited by a sitting president of the United States to disrupt the peaceful transfer of presidential power. And Murray also said by engaging in an insurrection against the Constitution, Trump disqualified himself from public office. And he now says the Supreme Court should carve out an exception that would apply only to him because Trump is the only former president, except George Washington, who didn't hold office before he was elected president. But most of the members of the court all but ignored Trump's participation in the January 6th insurrection, which was the greatest threat to the survival of the Republic since the Civil War. And Section 3 was enacted after the Civil War to disqualify people from holding office who had served in government prior to the war, but then supported the Confederacy. Interestingly, although he denied that Trump engaged in insurrection, Trump's attorney, Jonathan Mitchell, characterized the events of January 6th as, and I quote, "This was a riot. It was not an insurrection. The events were shameful, criminal, violent, all of those things, but did not qualify as insurrection, as that term is used in Section 3, unquote. That's an incredible admission that he's saying it was criminal. And although Section 3 does not require that an official who has sworn an oath to support the Constitution be convicted of insurrection to be disqualified from the presidency, Kavanaugh was concerned about that.
Several members of the court, Marjorie, claimed to be originalists. What is that, and did they demonstrate commitment to originalism during the oral argument?
Well, these originalists who professed to consider the original public meaning at the time the 14th Amendment was added to the Constitution disregarded explicit comments on the floor of the Senate during the debate on Section 3 that the president is indeed an officer. John Bingham, who was the lead author of the 14th Amendment, referred to the president as an officer. And 29 historians concluded in two different amicus briefs in this case that officer was meant to include the president. The Colorado Supreme Court said, President Trump asks us to hold that Section 3 disqualifies every oath-breaking insurrectionist except the most powerful one, and that it bars oath-breakers from virtually every office, both state and federal, except the highest one in the land. Both results are inconsistent with the plain language and history of Section 3. Now, as required by originalism, the Colorado court did a detailed analysis of the text and the history of Section 3. For purposes of the January 6th attack, the Colorado court defined insurrection as a concerted and public use of force or threat of force by a group of people to hinder or prevent the U.S. government from taking the actions necessary to accomplish a peaceful transfer of power in this country. And on the issue of whether Trump himself personally engaged in insurrection on January 6th, the Colorado court said, the record amply demonstrates that President Trump fully intended to and did aid or further the insurrectionists' common unlawful purpose of preventing the peaceful transfer of power. He exhorted them to fight to prevent the certification of the 2020 presidential election. He personally took action to try to stop the certification. And for many hours, he and his supporters succeeded in halting that process. Now, on the question of whether presidents are, quote, officers of the United States within the meaning of Section 3, the Colorado court said, the plain meaning of office under the United States includes the presidency. It follows then that the president is an officer of the United States. Indeed, Americans have referred to the president as an officer from the days of the founding. Section 3's drafters and their contemporaries understood the president as an officer of the United States.
What was the political concern of most of the members of the Supreme Court?
Well, that's a good question. In their brief, the attorneys representing the Colorado voters noted, the thrust of Trump's position is less legal than it is political. He not so subtly threatens bedlam if he's not on the ballot, but we already saw the bedlam Trump unleashed when he was on the ballot and lost. Alito and Roberts were uneasy about the chaos that disqualifying Trump from the ballot might unleash. Of course, they weren't so concerned about the chaos that overturning Roe v. Wade would unleash, or upholding the voter suppression measures and shooting down gun control measures. They weren't concerned about chaos at all. Roberts worried about the possibility of a plethora of disqualifications of both Republican and Democratic candidates. He said, I would expect a goodly number of states will say, whoever the Democratic candidate is, you're off the ballot.
And what was Sonia Sotomayor's apparent position?
Well, she appeared skeptical of Attorney Mitchell's interpretation of the non-self-executing nature of Section 3. Sotomayor also questioned the validity of Griffin's case as a precedent for the Supreme Court, and she noted that the history of states disqualifying individuals from state elections existed, and she labeled as a gerrymandered argument Mitchell's suggestion that the president is not an officer of the United States. Sotomayor also expressed skepticism about Trump's position on the self-executing issue, and Sotomayor asked Mitchell, you want us to say that self-execution doesn't mean what it generally means? You want us now to say it means that Congress must require states to stop insurrectionists from taking office? So this is a complete preemption. That's very rare, isn't it? And then Sotomayor cynically asked Mitchell, are you setting up so that if some president I wonder who, runs for a third term that a state can't disqualify him from the ballot. And I thought that was very insightful. And then with respect to Griffin's case, Sotomayor noted that in addition to it not being a Supreme Court decision, Justice Salmon Chase, who wrote the opinion in Griffin's case when he was an appellate court judge, he reversed his view on the matter a few years before in the Davis case, where he assumed that Jefferson Davis would be ineligible to hold any office, particularly the presidency. And Sotomayor called the Griffin case a non-precedential decision that relies on policy, doesn't look at the language, doesn't look at the history, doesn't analyze anything than the disruption that such a suit would bring. You want us to credit as precedential?
So, Marjorie, what do you think the court is likely to decide and what scenarios might follow?
Well, it's hard to decide what issue they're all going to agree on, or some of them. There may well be concurring opinions. And the clearest center of gravity seemed to be the Griffin's case argument that Section 3 is not self-executing, that it requires federal legislation. Some members of the court seemed persuaded that Section 3 itself doesn't even cover the presidency because he's not an officer under the United States. And some seemed to like the idea that Section 3 only applied to holding office, not running for it. If the Supreme Court holds just that states like Colorado cannot disqualify federal candidates, or that Section 3 only applies to eligibility to hold office and not to appear on a ballot as a candidate, then Trump's disqualification from the presidency may remain a live issue in federal court later in the election process or even after he assumes office, leaving questions about the substantive scope of Section 3 unresolved may put Congress itself in the difficult position of having to decide whether Trump is disqualified as it's counting the electoral votes on January 6th, 2025. Only if the court resolves the question of how to read Section 3 itself by holding that Section 3 requires federal implementing legislation or that it doesn't apply to the presidency will the issue be firmly settled in advance of the election.
That's bound to be interesting. The Supreme Court has agreed to decide whether Trump has immunity from prosecution for acts committed while he was president. What do you think is likely to happen in that case?
Well, the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit decided that Trump did not have immunity for all acts committed during the presidency, legal or illegal. And so the Supreme Court has agreed to hear that issue. And the timing of when the Supreme Court decides that issue is really critical. First of all, I suspect, and of course, this is reading the tea leaves, I suspect that a unanimous Supreme Court will say that he is not immune. But regardless of what they say, if they stretch this out long enough so that there is no trial and conviction of Trump on one of his four cases before the election, then they would be influencing the election. Now, many voters who support Trump say that a criminal conviction could change their minds. So we will see whether the Supreme Court, they really should quickly just refuse to hear the case. They should have refused to hear the case and let the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals decision stand. That would have been the easy way out, but they're going to weigh in and they may set a briefing schedule and prolong it until there is no conviction before the election. Now, I understand that the judge in the New York case about the Stormy Daniels issue has just confirmed a trial date of March 25th. So it's possible that Trump might have a criminal conviction before the election, but we'll see what the Supreme Court says. If this issue of whether he's immune or not to criminal prosecution is stretched out by the Supreme Court, then then it could well affect the election. And then we'll see a repeat of Bush v. Gore, when in the year 2000, the Supreme Court forgot that it champions states' rights and stopped the Florida Supreme Court from counting the ballots and basically installed George W. Bush as president. So we might see a kind of a similar repeat of that if the Supreme Court implicitly or explicitly inserts itself into this election.
Yes, indeed. Marjorie, we're out of time. How can our listeners follow your work?
Well, I have a column on truthout.org. It's called Human Rights and Global Wrongs. And also all of my articles and videos and radio interviews, etc., books are collected on my website, marjoriecohn.com.
Marjorie, thank you so much for following the oral argument so closely and for dissecting it for us.
Thanks a lot, Heidi. Thanks for having me on.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Analysis of the coverage of Israel's war on Gaza by three major newspapers, the New York Times, Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times, reveals consistent bias against Palestinians, according to a recent report by The Intercept. The analysis, which examined more than 1,000 articles from these publications during the first 6 weeks of Israel's assault, focused on usage of key terms and their contextual framing. The study uncovered significant disparities in the reporting of casualties and the emotional language used. Terms like slaughter and massacre were disproportionately applied when describing the killings of Israelis compared to Palestinians. For example, editors and reporters used the word slaughter 60 times to describe the killing of Israelis, but only used it once when referring to Palestinians. The word massacre was used 125 times to describe the killing of Israelis, but only used twice for Palestinians. And the word horrific was used 36 times in the context of Israeli casualties, compared to just 4 times for Palestinians. Despite the fact that Israel's genocide in Gaza has caused an unprecedented loss of life among children, with more than 10,000 reported fatalities as of the present, only 2 headlines out of more than 1,100 news articles in the study mention the word children in connection with Gazan victims. Similarly, the plight of journalists, with more than 100 Palestinian reporters killed due to the Israeli bombardment, receives scant attention. The word journalists and its iterations, such as reporters and photojournalists, appeared in only 9 headlines in more than 1,100 articles. Joining us today is journalist and critical media literacy expert Misha Jerakulis. Misha is the curriculum development coordinator at Project Censored and serves on the editorial board of the Censored Press and the Markaz Review. She writes about journalistic ethics and standards, press and academic freedoms, identity and culture, and the protracted disinformation campaign against the Armenian genocide. Misha, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. I am a regular listener and fan of Law and Disorder, and so honored to be here.
Oh, our pleasure. Misha, before we talk about coverage of Gaza, have you seen other topics that have received biased news coverage in the past?
Yes, definitely. And some examples would include reporting on U.S. politics. Cable news and social media are notoriously biased. Red versus blue election coverage and the overuse of opinion polls and horse race reporting. In coverage of college and university campus actions like protests, sit-ins, and vigils. Certainly on climate and energy issues with the use of select quote-unquote experts and official sources. On reporting around the federal budget, especially defense spending, and definitely in war reporting.
Yes, Misha, much more coverage in the U.S. corporate media on anti-Semitism than on Islamophobia. From a human rights perspective, what's the effect of such slanted coverage about the siege of Gaza in the corporate media in the United States?
For the people of Gaza, Palestine, and the wider region, and U.S. citizens and residents of Middle Eastern, North African, Southwest Asian heritage, that slant is so diminishing, so dehumanizing and devaluing, and denies them the same rights accorded to everyone simply by virtue of being part of humanity. For audiences of U.S. newspapers and media outlets, biased reporting is a breach of journalistic code of ethics, which instructs reporters to seek truth and report it. This breach interferes with the public's right to and need for accurate information. Thinking in those terms, biased reporting becomes a social justice issue. And according to Article 19 of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression, including the freedom to hold opinions without interference, and to seek and receive information through any media. So then, reporting that's biased, lacks transparency, or presents decontextualized material or data, interferes with that right's articulation of the seeker's right to obtain information.
Now, Misha, you alluded to ethics. Let's talk about journalistic ethics. What standards govern how journalists in the United States report?
Hands down, the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics is considered the gold standard of reporting. The preamble to that code states the belief that public enlightenment is the forerunner of justice and the foundation of democracy, and appeals to the integrity of journalists everywhere. Newsrooms, large and small, far and wide, invariably have those ethics posted up somewhere. We know about those ethics. They are heart and soul guidelines that remind us to seek truth and report it, to minimize harm, to act independently, and to be accountable and transparent.
Let's talk about two recent pieces that you co-authored with our co-host Heidi Boghossian, criticizing a New York Times article and later two op-ed pieces in The Times and The Wall Street Journal. Let's start with the New York Times piece. What was your basic criticism?
You know, returning to the SBJ Code of Ethics for just a moment, I'd like to point out that one of the guidelines instructs journalists and reporters to provide context, to take special care not to misrepresent or oversimplify in summarizing a story. So with that in mind, what stood out most glaringly in the January 11th New York Times article was the decontextualized presentation of Raphael Lemkin's work to define the crimes against humanity that, until the formal endorsement of his word genocide, had no name and no real consequences. That New York Times article implied that Lemkin defined the word genocide solely for the Jewish Holocaust, and that that somehow provided justification for Israel's categorical rejection of South Africa's allegation that Israel was perpetrating genocide in Gaza. The article gave the impression that because Jewish people suffered the Holocaust, Israel would therefore be absolved of any accusations of crimes in Gaza. That editorial spin displayed faulty logic, among other things, did a disservice to Lemkin's entire body of work, as well as to the principles of ethical reporting and public debate.
Amisha, if I can just chime in on this to let our audience know that you and I are both Armenian Americans. So that article resonated with us, given Lemkin's concern and really being inspired by the Armenian genocide early in the 20th century.
And that set his work in motion.
In our joint article titled From Jihadist Dearborn to Middle East Insects, with jihadist and insects in quotation marks, that ran in Consortium News, can you describe the problems with two opinion pieces, one in the Wall Street Journal and one in the New York Times, and clarify, don't op-eds and opinion pieces generally have more leeway than news articles in terms of their, quote, objectivity?
Oh, absolutely. Opinion writing arguably is not journalism. However, one of the purposes of publishing opinion pieces is to offer audiences a range of perspectives. Considering the Times and the Journal, two papers that enjoy the privilege of being recognized as American newspapers of record, and considering these two op-ed writers we focused on, one a seasoned reporter and the other a so-called expert on Middle East media, the expectation for ethical, elucidating writing is high. Irrespective of SVJ code of ethics, both the Times and the Journal have their own guidelines and standards for op-ed writing, and presumably depend on their readers' trust. The New York Times guidelines, as we pointed out, say that an op-ed should present a solid position that can be strongly, persuasively argued based on principles and facts, and either propose a solution to a problem or defend a position. Similarly, Wall Street Journal's guidelines instruct their op-ed writers to make a strong argument on an issue in the news. Neither of those op-eds offered any sort of thoughtful analysis, logical argumentation, clarifying ideas, or factual documentation. They added nothing of practical or moral value to the national discourse on Hamas and Israel, and they broke from their own publisher standards.
Interesting. Misha, what are some of the primary ways that the U.S. corporate media demonstrate bias?
You know, I want to go back for a moment and mention a 1988 book by Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky, because it sets the stage. The book is called Manufacturing Consent, and it basically shattered the illusion that corporate and legacy media serve as a check on power. Herman and Chomsky came up with what they called the propaganda model, a framework for analyzing U.S. media in terms of the power that the establishment and interest groups exert over social, economic, and political agendas. One of the things that they spotlighted was the notion of worthy and unworthy victims. Victims of enemies of the United States and its client states are worthy victims. Herman and Chomsky came up with five filters, and I would like to just mention these because they're still very useful today in analyzing media performance with regards to propaganda and bias. I'll just run through those five, if I may. The first is ownership, advertising, sources. The fourth is FLAC, F-L-A-K, meaning complaints, threats, punitive actions taken against reporters or publishers who divert from an official position. And the fifth filter is fear. That is fear of a targeted or imagined enemy. So thinking about these five elements, these five filters, media bias can be seen in hyperbolic and fear-inducing headlines, through framing techniques, false equivalencies, use of the passive voice or vague language, in opinion pieces that dog whistle and scapegoat, in the spin that labels anyone who calls for ceasefire or for Palestinian rights as anti-Semitic, and in op-eds that overwhelmingly provide a pulpit to the same people who reiterate one perspective. I think our consortium news article really highlighted that last point. And just a side note on those two op-ed writers, the Wall Street Journal op-ed was written by the executive director of the Middle East Media Research Institute, which SourceWatch calls an Israeli propaganda organization closely aligned with Israeli intelligence. SourceWatch also lists the New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, the other op-ed writer that we addressed, as a user of Middle East Media Research Institute materials. To me, that information captures the one perspective bias. Two op-eds published in two different newspapers on the very same day, essentially saying the same thing in different ways.
Biased coverage in the corporate media has led to pro-Israel pundits blaming pro-Palestinian views on social media as, quote, misinformation. Does a traditional media spill over into social media and vice versa?
You know, that's a great question. Discrediting pro-Palestinian views on social media is nothing new. Reversing blame or victim blaming is a common tactic to shift the spotlight from one party's actions onto the victim or over to the party with which it's fighting. Poisoning the well, that is, seeking to preemptively discredit an opponent, it's a tactic to avoid scrutiny. We see this in cancel culture, the attempt to shut down those with opposing views or to call information that's not to one's liking or doesn't fit with a particular agenda as fake news. So thinking about the Times and the Journal, we expect nation's premier newspapers to maintain a higher standard of professionalism than posts on social media. But the Times and the Journal prove that they're willing to breach their own editorial guidelines, to me, calling their trustworthiness into question. And as trust in traditional media erodes, and as the biases in reporting become more apparent to more people, news consumers are turning to social media for information, which is even more prone to biases and fake news than traditional media. That's so troubling for a multitude of reasons, not the least of which is the barrage of deep fake videos and online images meant to deceive and manipulate viewers. It's especially troubling when politicians and celebrity influencers who have huge followings use social media to share or repost unvetted information, whether they do it because it agrees with their biases or advances an agenda, or because they simply lack the skills to prove or disprove the veracity of what they're posting, they perpetuate biases and information silos. And so then, predictably, what a politician or celebrity does online shows up in traditional media. So it does seem like the lines between traditional and social media are blurring.
My co-host Heidi Bogosian and I, Marjorie Cohn, are speaking with Misha Jerakulis about media bias in favor of Israel. Misha, pro-Palestinian activists have accused major publications of pro-Israel bias, and you're keeping a critical eye on coverage, but not many people are. Could you tell us how that needs to change?
This is where critical media literacy skills are invaluable for evaluating media content. Critical media literacy goes beyond basic media literacy to analyze the content of what's being said, who's saying it, whose story is being told, who's publishing the story, and who's paying for the story. In other words, it looks at the construction of content, representation and narratives, power dynamics, production and distribution. Unfortunately, critical media literacy is not required learning in U.S. public education system. But media scholars and educators, and definitely those of us at Project Censored, believe that if students and citizens possess critical media literacy skills, it could be a game changer in terms of personal and civic empowerment. If citizens realize how elite media ownership and consolidation, social media algorithms, and political lobbying groups control the narratives and play into our human biases, they might make different choices, not just about their media consumption, but about how they weigh in on policies and for whom they choose to be their elected leaders.
Misha, we have a few minutes remaining. You're involved with Project Censored. Can you briefly describe Project Censored and describe how their work dovetails with the U.S. media generally?
Yes. First and foremost, Project Censored sees the media as a public good and journalism as a public service. It was founded in 1976 by media scholar Carl Jensen at Sonoma State University, and the mission was educational, teaching about censorship in all its forms, propaganda, bias, and critical media literacy, even though it wasn't called that at the time. A quick word on critical media literacy. The long-standing definition of media literacy is the ability to access, analyze, evaluate, create, and act to all forms of communication, including mass communication and media, popular culture, and digital technologies. Critical media literacy takes media literacy further by teaching learners to interrogate and challenge dominant power dynamics, themes, and narratives in the media, and provide skills for talking back. We at Project Censored view media analysis as both educational and as advocacy work, leaning into the purpose of the Fourth Estate to hold the powerful to account and to uphold the public's right to know. Project Censored then and now functions as sort of a media watchdog, spotlighting, and I'll quote a tagline, the news that didn't make the news and why. We're looking at stories, what stories are being told, who in the media is controlling the narrative, who's actually given the right to speak. Some of this can be heard on Project Censored's weekly public affairs radio show that's aired on your sister station, KPFA, and across stations throughout the country, as well as on podcasts and YouTube. For more than three decades now, Project Censored has produced an annual book titled The State of the Free Press, which has a wide readership and is used in our campus affiliates programs, in college and university journalism and communications programs in the U.S. and Canada and beyond. Project Censored also produces educational curricula, documentary film, academic and professional conferences, and I could go on, but I'll leave it there for now.
Misha, Project Censored is doing such critical work. If it didn't exist, we would have to create it. When readers see something in the news that they think is unbalanced or biased, what should they do?
I would say approach the news with healthy skepticism and, in a best-case scenario, through a critical media lens. If reading text online, read laterally. Look for other articles on the topic and compare the coverage. And do not rely strictly on Google. Use non-tracking search engines and compare your search results. Pay attention to bylines. Look up the writer or reporter who's authored an article or op-ed. If the information is in video or image, look for evidence that it was created and published by a credible source. If the source is not transparent, then look up the publisher. And ultimately, if information is questionable or unverifiable, resist the temptation to share.
And Misha, if I can add, readers should speak out, write letters to the editors, and try to hold the media accountable.
100%. Absolutely.
Misha, how can our listeners follow your work on social media and elsewhere?
Thank you for asking. As part of the Project Censored team, some of my work is on the website, projectcensored.org. Some of my work can also be found at the Markaz Review, themarkaz.org. I still use X, formerly Twitter, to some extent, and I'm on LinkedIn and have a Muckrack page.
Well, Misha, it's been a true pleasure. We have to let you go for now, but thank you for being a vigilant eye, holding a vigilant eye on the U.S. media, and for being with us on Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much for having me. It was my privilege and pleasure.
Thanks, Misha.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.